Publishing Talks, a podcast about books and the publishing industry. I'm David Wilk, your host. And today I'm talking to Ken White. He's the founder, owner, and publisher of Sutherland House, a book publishing company located in Toronto, Canada. And I've been interested in talking to Ken for a while, having now been reading his really interesting weekly newsletter, and where in which he writes a lot about ideas that I think are really interesting. So nice to have you here, Ken.
Glad to be here, David.
Thank you. Well, it's hard to know where to start because you've been doing this a long time, as have I. So maybe we could just start with some historical, like where you could talk a little bit about your background, particularly how you started. I know you started in journalism, but then kind of how you got into publishing books.
You know, I kind of always wanted to be in books. I was interested in books, reading books, long before I got interested in newspapers or magazines. But I grew up in Edmonton, Canada, where there weren't a lot of publishing companies. In fact, I think there were one at the time. But there was a lot of journalism, and there was opportunity jobs in journalism. And so, I started off as a reporter, became an editor, worked in newspapers, worked in magazines, and I kept I had a wonderful career in journalism, wouldn't give any of it back, but I always kind of felt that I got robbed of a career in books, and I was always trying to find a way into the industry. I actually, in my 20s, looked very seriously at starting a bookstore in Edmonton. Thank God I didn't do it, because it was just, before Amazon came on the scene, before all the big book chains came on the scene, followed by Amazon, I would have got killed. So I dodged a bullet there. And then I wrote a few books while I was practicing journalism, and I always tried to stay interested and informed about the book industry. And then when I finally, felt like I left it all on the floor in terms of newspapers and magazines, and those business models were going down the tubes, books looked a relative oasis of financial sanity. I mean, in newspapers and magazines, they were giving away their content online, and the advertising model was broken. At least in books, people were still able to charge a full price, a fair price for the book, and even the digital versions, the ebooks and the audiobooks. So it looked like a better environment to. I wasn't going to retire. I wanted to keep working. And books just looked a little more appealing. So I kind of launched Sutherland House and lived out my dream of working in the book industry.
So what year did you start Sutherland House?
5 years ago.
Okay. So, it has not been around as long as I thought. Somehow it might be just the name exudes, solidity, and so it made me think that you'd been doing this for a longer
time. Well, the name's kind of funny. I mean, I originally thought, why wouldn't I do it like everyone else and just name it after myself? But my daughter pointed out to me that white books might sound like a bit of a trigger point, so we named it Sutherland House after the street I live on, which is Sutherland Drive. And as my wife likes to say, it's now named for the house that we'll lose if this all goes bad.
And when you first started, did you identify an area of publishing that you wanted to tackle, to specialize in?
Very much, yeah. Again, my past as a journalist and also my history as a writer, I've written a biography of Herbert Hoover and another book about William Randolph Hearst and another book about General Motors. So very much narrative nonfiction. That's where my strengths are, and any claimed expertise I have is. And it turns out that you know, in the Canadian market and to an extent in the U.S. market as well, the fiction space is a lot more crowded than the nonfiction space. So I thought it made some sense to specialize in that. So we do narrative nonfiction, history, biography, current affairs, some sports, a lot of arts and entertainment recently, which has been fun. We don't do self-help or how-tos, just narrative nonfiction.
And maybe we should talk a little bit about the difference between Canadian publishing and American publishing, because for people, most of my listeners, I assume, are in the United States, may not know as much about Canada, and there are significant differences, historically, partly because Canada, because you are a smaller country and, well, smaller number of people, not smaller geographically, but there has been a longstanding effort to protect Canadian culture and to prevent the behemoth in the South from producing so many media products, not just books, but everything else, that we overwhelm the Canadian culture. And so the Canadian government, this is your story, not mine, but just to summarize it, Canadian government has really worked hard to make it possible for Canadian publishing to exist. I'm sure your perspective on that, it will differ from mine as an outsider, but from my perspective, it seems like a really good idea. But it also makes it, I'm sure it comes with challenges as well.
Well, this is very sensitive of you, David, to notice that the Canadian environment is different. Not everyone I've met in U.S. publishing notices that. And you're absolutely right about the reasons why Canada has both protected and supported its cultural industries, because, you know, we're not a tiny country, but we are very small relative to the U.S., and we don't have any of the economies of scale that the American market offers. And so, you know, otherwise, if we didn't do some things to support our own arts, entertainment, journalism sectors, we'd be swamped with American content, which would be of higher quality, and it'd be really difficult for Canadians to tell stories, their own stories about themselves to each other, in that kind of environment. So, for the last 50 years, in particular, the federal government has been supporting, and I'm going to talk mostly about the book industry now because that's what we're focused on here. It's been subsidizing Canadian book publishers through something called the Canada Council for the Arts. There are a couple of other programs as well, but that's the main one. And it's been a really interesting experiment with a lot of mixed results. On the one hand, it has left us with a couple hundred independent publishers that we may or may not have, if there probably wouldn't have that many if there wasn't support for them. And it's allowed these publishers to find a lot of good Canadian authors and launch a lot of talent, Margaret Atwood, Alice Munro, Mike Londaci, among the Canadian authors who were beneficiaries of this system. So it's definitely had its successes. But at the same time, there are inevitable downsides whenever you bring a government body into an industry in a big way. They can't resist not only supporting you, but subtly and sometimes unsubtly directing you. And one of the consequences that we have in Canada is that because everyone's dependent on Canada Council for the Arts funding, and the Canada Council for the Arts takes the art part of its mandate very, very seriously, we have an overwhelming preponderance of literary publishers doing a lot of literary fiction and poetry. We are really weak on, say, genre fiction and on any kind of research nonfiction. So it skews the market that way. I go down to the U.S. and what I see in the U.S. is a far more dynamic market. And there is, even adjusting for population, there's just a lot more publishing companies and a lot more publishing activity in the U.S. And it's of a different kind as well. I go to the conventions of the Independent Book Publishers Association, and everyone you meet there has a really tightly focused business relative to things you'd see in Canada. You know, I met at the last time I went, a woman who just did books for military families, children, spouses of military personnel. Another guy who just did how-to books about different kinds of software, so how to use Excel, how to use Word, and so on. And another guy who just did books about explaining Japanese culture to Americans. So they're very tightly focused. They know their audiences. They don't have any support from granting agencies or anything. They're, for-profit operations that live and die by selling books. So they really know their audiences, and they tend to be a lot savvier about marketing than Canadian book publishers, who are getting often anywhere from 30, 60, I've seen as high as 70% of the revenue of some of these companies coming from public sources rather than from the marketplace. So, you get in the U.S. a much more enterprising and tightly focused public than you would in Canada on the whole.
So does it work, that the Canada Council does not support your nonfiction publishing?
The only kind of nonfiction that they will enthusiastically support is what they consider nonfiction that is artistic in intent and execution. So, and they define that by the voice of the author being predominant. So personalized essays and memoir tend to get supported. Research fact-based nonfiction like biography, science writings, sports writing, not so much.
So that means that for the nonfiction books you do, and I sort of maybe liken this to English publishers who have a small, like you have a smaller native market than, say, U.S. publishers do, and British publishers have become export-minded. They're often either selling rights or selling physical books in other places in order to increase their market share. I am guessing that would work for you as well. You could publish the book in Canada, but you could sell it anywhere. So while the Canadian market might be, 40 million people, you can still access the U.S. market for a nonfiction book that's a general reader audience. Maybe not for as much for a book that is literally about Canada or a Canadian polit. Let's say you did a published a book about Canadian political issues. That would be hard to sell anywhere else. But general nonfiction or books that are about subjects of interest more universally, presumably you can compete on equal ground as any American publisher.
Yeah, this is, again, one of the perversities of, government support or unintended consequences anyway. Publishers who are having success, independent publishers who are having success in Canada, even though they're being supported to be Canadian publishers and supported to tell Canadian stories to Canadians, most of the ones who are having success tend to do books that are not identifiably Canadian, that will sell in a global market, because if you can, if you have a sales and distribution operation on both sides of the border, as we do, you can slip into the American stream and get the advantage of that much bigger market. And so the independents who are successful are doing that. And you see it especially in the kids publishing sector in Canada, which is probably the strongest, was by far the strongest section or sector of book publishing that we have. And because kids' books tend to backlist well and travel well to other markets, I think it's 6 or 7 of our 10 biggest publishers are kids publishers or have substantial kids publishing arms. Because, you know, there's nothing particularly Canadian about or identifiably Canadian about a kid's book for the most part.
Right. No, I've noticed that for a long time. Mm-hmm. The number of children's book publishers in Canada who are successful in the U.S. and maybe in other places as well, definitely kind of punching above their weight, if you want to use that
absolutely
metaphor. Yeah. So you tend to observe what's going on in the industry, and I think you've written about it in your newsletter. The issues that we're faced with, different from what journalism has had to deal with, or magazine publishing, but book publishing is still, I think, challenged. Maybe less so than other, we've seemed to withstood all kinds of challenges, that people thought would upend the business and only modified it, and the business has been pretty good about it, adaptation, and readers seem to be, maybe you want to say the word conservative, readers read. And so, the book business hasn't changed as much as magazines, but in the future, I think it's safe to say there are issues currently that are going to become more of a challenge in the future. And I assume you're thinking about those things, and maybe trite to even ask this, but, what's your thinking about AI, for example, since everybody's thinking about AI right now?
Yeah. Well, I do think a lot about these things, and I do tend to, I spent 40 years as a journalist, and those observational habits are hard to break. So the newsletter it's called Shush, Shush, and it's on Substack, and it's kind of a way for me to learn about what's going on in the industry and comment on the industry and kind of keep a toe in the journalistic waters. And there are a lot of, huge issues in publishing now, almost everywhere you look, our author incomes are just terrible. And the volume of books that are being published, 700,000-800,000 books published every year in the U.S. market. And, for any publisher to break through that and find an audience for a book is getting increasingly difficult. And the middlemen in the industry, distributors, Amazon, the book chains, are increasingly squeezing value out of the value chain and leaving less for publishers and authors. So, we may not be magazines and newspapers, but we certainly have our share of problems. As for AI, it's a whole slate of problems, depending on whether you're looking at it from the inputs to AI and the way that these companies are just running roughshod over copyright in order to train their systems, and then on the output side, it's going to flood the market with even more content. There's much more danger of so-called AI publishers producing product that very closely mimics the work of authors. So, there's a real range of of problems on the AI front, and they're just several of the many facing book publishing.
Well, that's true. You think about presumably you get submissions of books from agents, mm-hmm. but you also will get them from authors who are unagented, unrepresented. Have you noticed or have you had to grapple with AI affecting the proposals or the nature of the writing that you're getting? Have you noticed anything happening on that front?
I haven't seen anything like that myself, but I imagine that it's happening. The tech people really piss me off because they go on about how AI is going to change the world, AI is going to save the world, AI is going to do all these great things, and against everything they're going to accomplish, our copyright doesn't amount to a hill of beans, and so they assume that they have a right given what they're trying to do and have yet to prove they can do essentially take our intellectual properties. I can go on forever about how angry they can make me, but at the same time, the tools are kind of useful too. It's not all a bad thing. I find myself, especially since ChatGPT started using sources and giving you sources in response to prompts, I've found it to be actually hugely useful in a lot of circumstances. So if I'm editing, I was recently editing a manuscript about banks, and it's not a subject I'm really familiar with, but every time something came up about this aspect of bank policy or some international comparison or this or that, I was able to use ChatGPT to get answers a lot more quickly than I ever would have before, just following links off Google. And generally speaking, there was a high degree of accuracy and speed. And so, it can be a useful tool, but I don't think it's ever going to be close to being capable of writing a first-rate manuscript. Most of the writing I've seen, and even from people who are really well practiced in with AI tools, the best they can do still smells of AI when you read it. And I spoke to a woman at the University of Toronto. Toronto's been one of the world centers in AI development, and she's been in the middle of it. Asked her if AI was ever going to be able to adequately proofread a manuscript for me. She didn't think so. Even 5-10 years out, when these things are all trained out, she thinks there'll still be very much a need for a human eye, just because of all the nuances of language that a machine will never be able to pick up. So,
that's interesting. I have thought that it would be in the production side of publishing and potentially.
That's what I was hoping. Yeah.
Yeah. If you're going to, I don't necessarily think that the machine could or would eliminate the need for human beings, but it should be able to aid and cut down the workload for human beings. I did, try to figure out how it might work, but the problem is, at least I find, and I don't know whether you share this, is that we're really busy in our work. It's really hard to find time to add a new discipline to our, to our toolkit. So to learn AI as you should, it's almost like learning a language. So here you're working in your field, you're busy all the time. Where are you going to find time to actually master the tool and figure out how it can work in a really meaningful way? I think there are people doing that, but I'm not sure that they are the people who are in the field doing the actual work. And it's sort of similar to the period when the industries were being computerized. Well, they needed to talk to people who actually did the work to find out how do you automate processes? Because if you're just no offense to people who write code, but they write code, they don't know what to people who are doing the work actually do. So you have to have a coder and a human being who literally can extract the workflow and describe it to the person who's writing code so they can actually meaningfully write code. And that took a lot of years. You know, it was many, many years of that kind of work going on by millions of people doing it. I kind of foresee that happening with AI, that we each need an assistant who understands this, who can work together with us to make it actually work for us.
Yeah, I think that's true. I have some hope that the tools will get better over time and more user-friendly over time. But I think you have to embrace the complexity they bring to things. When I started in book publishing in my mid-50s, and the reason I did it was in part because I wanted to keep learning skills, new skills. I wanted to keep up with things. I didn't want to become one of those people who, in my last working job, who were, at an age where they never really adapted to email and were still printing out their emails every day, that kind of thing. I didn't want to end up that way. And so one of the reasons I'm doing this is to force myself to keep up and learn new technologies. And, the kids who work with me, my staff's mostly 20s, early 30s, and they pick these things up a lot quicker than I do. But I feel like I can at least try to keep up with them. And it keeps things interesting and hopefully keeps me a bit younger.
Well, I think actually publishing is good in that way, that because we've had to adapt to change, but you also have to learn how things have been done before. In order to change effectively, you really need to be looking both forward and backward at the same time.
Yeah, it's amazing in book publishing. I mean, you got 400 years of history of publishing books on the North American continent, right? And at the same time, you look at just what's changed in the last 20 years with the onslaught of ebooks and audiobooks and now AI and so on. It's a really weird mix of very ancient technologies and processes and a lot of really disruptive new stuff.
And it's hard. It's been really hard to predict change. When ebooks were, kind of in their initial period of development, I think there were a lot of people who said no one will ever want to read an electronic device. And then there were other people who would say, it's the future. Everyone is going to be reading digitally. And my worry at that time was, my thought was that if ebooks took a large enough percentage of the business, that would drive print prices up because you'd be producing fewer copies. And, it's a economy of scale business. The fewer copies you print, the higher your cost is, the more you have to charge. And then I thought it would create a self-fulfilling, that cycle of higher print prices would drive more people to ebooks, and eventually it would shift so that e would be more predominant than print. Never happened. We've kind of reached a static area, kind of percentage of 75, 80, 85% print, 15, 20% ebook, and it doesn't seem to be changing in any direction at this point.
I'm not sure it's over, David. I wouldn't be surprised in the next. I've seen a lot of book prices going up, and especially since the pandemic, paper prices went up, also labor prices are going up, and so it is costing more to print books. We've been encouraged by our sales teams and our distributors to, get the full price we can for our books. The data I've seen shows that book prices one of the reasons that publishers are looking okay today is despite slight declines year over year in the number of books being sold, is because they're selling the books for more than they were back in 2018, 2019. And it's good that they're able to, get sales at higher price points. But at some point, I do think that forces more people to alternatives like ebooks. It'll be interesting to see over the next 5 years whether what you rightly identify as some period of stability right now in the pricing of the different formats, whether it holds.
And the other thing actually just made me think of this, that technology of ebook reading has not progressed very far from what it was 20 years ago. That could change at any time. Somebody could come along and create a better ebook experience. I mean, I actually think the ebook e-reading experience is pretty poor and could bear a lot more innovation in software and technology. Mm-hmm. And I just learned of this thing I had not ever heard of before called SOL, S-O-L reading. It's an e-reader in glasses. So it basically closes off. I've never tried it. I haven't bought it. I have no idea whether it's any good. But the concept was really interesting. Put on the glasses, you can read. The world is shut off from you when mm-hmm. you hear that. So you're not distracted. You're not holding the print book and being, worried by your screen over here. And you're not holding a device and looking down. You're actually sitting, reading in any direction you want to. And I thought, well, who knows? Maybe eventually reading in some holographic projective way might alter the way people feel about digital reading, and then changes everything. Because if there was a huge uptake in e-reading, that really would change the dynamics. You would
absolutely
have to shift everything to print on demand. And do you use any POD technology to print your books, or
not a lot, but occasionally, especially with backlists.
Right. So the printing quality is great. Not as good as offset, but still pretty good. But unit cost is higher. So you print those 50 copies, and your cost is high. So your retail price is going to be higher. And we could get to there eventually. That could happen.
I think you're right about, the ebook technology. And I would say the audiobook experience as well. The book, as I say, is very old technology. I don't think it's going to change at all, the actual physical book, because that format is pretty much baked. But I wouldn't be surprised to see technological developments in ebooks and with audiobooks. Just in the last 5-10 years, the quality of the performances and audiobooks, some of them are spectacularly good. And it's a lot different from I don't know if you ever used to listen to books on cassette or books on CD. I mean, they were nowhere near the quality of things you can get for even, B-grade, C-grade books. You get incredibly talented people reading them, and it's a transformative experience. So I think we're still, in terms of the new formats, closer to the beginning than the end in terms of their evolution.
So speaking of that, do you publish your own audiobooks, or do you license to the audiobook world?
We've done both. We sell rights and usually prefer to sell rights, because we're in this wonderful period right now where there's a lot of audiobook services and audiobook providers competing for market share. So, the Blackstones, the Tantor, Spotify's in there now. The big publishers like Penguin Random House have bought a couple of our books. So as long as they're all competing for properties, they're paying well. And they're paying us more than we could expect to make producing our own audiobook and selling it ourselves. But we do in other circumstances where we don't have the ability to sell. We use the ACX platform at Audible, which is a, you know, hate to say nice things about Amazon, but it's a really good tool.
No, I hear you. They are the behemoth, but, you know, they'll do some good things. So now in Canada, just to go back to the Canadian market a little bit, the book selling in Canada used to be, I felt, pretty strong. You know, the number of bookstores per capita, let's say, notwithstanding Indigo as the main chain there, but even with independent stores, you know, you seem to have a fairly high number of stores. I haven't really kept up in the last year, so I'm not sure if that's still true. But does the Canadian bookselling ecosystem function well for you and for other Canadian publishers?
Well, Indigo is our Barnes and Noble, right? And it's by far the dominant bricks and mortar retailer in the country. And we do have some really good independent bookstores, but they're few and far between. We haven't seen what the U.S. has seen in about the last 10, 15 years since people got accustomed to Amazon's presence in the market. There's been in the U.S. A real increase, a substantial increase in the number of independent bookstores opening, partly because borders got out of the way, but also I think booksellers learn to find a place for themselves in the market that wasn't the big box experience and wasn't the kind of, you know, the what is increasingly an awful online experience on Amazon, and the independent booksellers are doing quite well in the U.S. We have not seen that yet here in Canada to anywhere near the same extent. We hope to see it, but it just hasn't happened yet.
And of course, there isn't an equivalent support system for Canadian retailing, book retailing, as there is for Canadian publishing. So,
no, there isn't. Now, there's some support, but nowhere near to the same extent. You know, we're a bit of a balkanized country. You know, Quebec has its own approach because, you know, they have sensitivities around the French language, and they have rules in place that really support booksellers in the province, and their particular bookselling community is a lot stronger than the rest of the country. So it's a little bit different here and there,
right? So that, which is kind of part of the idea of Quebec to encourage the speaking of French bookselling, makes sense to do that.
Yeah, and France is they take a lot of inspiration from France, and France is an outlier in Europe too. So it's all bound up in language politics.
So what about the other thing that I think about a lot for book publishers is, given the challenges, you know, Amazon is it's your primary retailer for almost every publisher now. Mm-hmm. It's always dangerous to have one big outlet for any business. It doesn't matter whether it's books or anything else. If they change their policies or they come after you for more discount, you know, you're at their mercy. You alluded to that earlier. And one of the things that, publishers that are thinking about kind of hedging that, is one way of doing that is to sell direct to consumer. And it's a tricky thing. Because you can be seen as competing with your retailers, and that's, people are not happy about that usually, the retailers, that is. And also, retailing is different from publishing. It's not the same business. Being a retailer as a publisher is hard. It's not easy, but it's something that a lot of publishers have experimented with and some have been successful doing. Is that something you've ever thought about?
Oh, I think about it all the time. I mean, you do the math on it, David, and a book you sell yourself, even if you are accounting for some mailing costs or delivery cost, our profits are three times better on a book we sell ourselves than one we sell through through a regular bookstore or through Amazon. And I think most independent publishers are in a very similar situation. And that was one of the things that really impressed me about the American publishers I've met. And I think one of the reasons that they stay so tightly focused is they get to really know their audience. The audience gets to know them, and it really facilitates direct sales. They have, long email lists and can get to their people directly whenever they've got a new release, which is a tremendous advantage. And so, yeah, direct sales are something we think about all the time. Also, repeat direct sales. We've started a series called Sutherland Quarterly, which is limited to the Canadian market, but it's a series of short books that come out four times a year. All of them regular books, all of them on different subjects, most of them to do with public affairs and politics in Canada. So we bring one out every 3 months, and we sell them in the bookstore as single copies like we do all our book. But you can also subscribe to them about $55 a year. And, even having several hundred subscribers for that, because the margin's so good, it gives each book that we bring out in this series a cushion that none of the other books have. They're almost profitable coming out of the gate on the basis of that small number of subscriptions. So we didn't invent that. An Australian firm called Black Ink, which is one of their good nonfiction publishers, had been doing it, and they're up to like 9,000 subscribers. And so pretty much every book they bring out in the series starts as a bestseller, which is a tremendous thing. And I've seen a number of British and European publishers, including Fitzcarraldo, which is like the hottest publisher in England right now, they all have subscription products of one kind or another, and it's just to facilitate the direct sales that you're talking about. It's very important for the business.
I think that's brilliant. I think it harkens back to the 19th century. That's how when publishers, booksellers were publishers, and they would subscribe, that's how they would publish, exactly. Right? Mm-hmm. And we're planning on publishing this series. You subscribe to it, we'll publish it. But of course, the challenge you alluded to a little bit there is you have to have people to talk to about it, and you have to have a subject area that is cohesive, almost like a brand, that makes sense for an audience that you can actually both identify and reach. Then your job is to do a good job of publishing to that audience. But I think the three challenges, really. One is reach, one is execution, and then one is the actual publishing of the book. So it's, not an easy thing.
No, it's not easy, but it's eminently doable. I mean, I spent a lot of time in magazines where everything was sold by subscription, it's important to have, as you mentioned, a clear focus with your product. You have to know what you write about and what you don't write about, and who you're selling to and who you're not selling to. And so if you're running Car and Driver, you don't do stories that belong in Vogue and vice versa, right? And when you start doing a lot of stories in a subscription product that are aimed at a particular audience, people who are interested in that subject will find it. They'll tell other people who are interested about it, that's the way subscription products have always succeeded. And to the extent that you can find something that people are really into, enthusiastic about as your subject matter,
Right. It helps if you are interested in that as well. In other
words, absolutely. You can't fake it. Yeah.
No, you have to. It's sort of like when you actually, you mentioned that you'd written a book about General Motors.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I've always thought that there is a big opportunity if you care about cars and the motorized transport, that somebody could specialize in being a publisher for not just by mark, not just books about Duesenberg or books about Rolls Royce. That there are companies that do that, publishers that do that really mm-hmm. well, but just the kind of overall people are really interested in cars and transportation.
Absolutely. And there's a lot of related things, roads and traffic that you can get into. And, it's a great subject area. I think you could definitely do that. And there's a big enthusiast community. And whenever you get a big enthusiast community, you have a good seedbed for a publishing company.
I mean, maybe maybe the two of us.
Okay.
Knock on that door. Well, okay. If I'm running out of time, so let me ask you one question, which this is sort of artificial. So if you don't answer it directly, that's fine. But if what's the one thing on your mind right now that we haven't talked about that you think is a really interesting subject or discussion point, to end with?
You want something about my business or about something about the book world at large?
I think book world at large, but whatever you think.
What's going on that's particularly... I want to... People are going to hate this, but what the hell? Give us all something to think about here. 4 out of 5 books in Canada are borrowed rather than read from public libraries. 3 out of 4 in the U.S. are borrowed rather than read in public libraries. I love libraries. I grew up in libraries. I use libraries all the time. I have nothing against libraries. But libraries have made a deliberate attempt in over the last several decades to increase their traffic by loading up on the hottest new books, fiction, nonfiction. They get their funding or they often make their pitches for funding from government bodies on the basis of traffic to public libraries and number of books that are borrowed, etc. And the way that they can goose those numbers is by having a lot of Michelle Obama or 50 Shades of Grey or whatever the hot book is at the moment. So they are very deliberately competing with the book trade on getting people to borrow rather than buy new book releases. And I think we have to make a decision as a society about whether we want to keep doing that or we want to move to some kind of a windowing strategy whereby, for 6 months or something, people in the book trade have, a sort of an open opportunity to sell books. Authors have an open opportunity to make some money for their books, and then they go to the libraries for free lending or something. Or if we think as a society that it's really important for everybody to have access to free books, then it's incumbent on the government to compensate publishers and authors for the service they're doing in providing those books. And I think we need to have an open conversation about that, because author incomes in the U.S., like in Canada, are just abysmal. It's like $10,000 a year the average author is making in book income. No, almost nobody's making a living from it. I don't want to make things harder for libraries. As I say, I love libraries, but when you have 3 out of 4 books being given away rather than bought, it is really hard for publishers and authors to make a living. So I would like to put that on the agenda. I hope they don't, you know, people that aren't already filling your comment section with me.
Well, but you know, there is an established model for that called the public lending right in England, mm-hmm. which is government subsidy of borrowing of books.
And basically, we have it here in Canada. We have one here in Canada.
Okay.
Well, it's desperately small and really makes no difference for people. The model is a great model, but it needs to be funded to a much, much higher degree than it is now.
That, of course, is the challenge. Yeah. I remember actually proposing that idea for the United States in 1980, I think, is when I tried to promote the idea of the public lending right, and it went zero. It went nowhere because the general theory was, who's going to vote for giving more money to public libraries? You know, even though it might be going to authors and publishers, no one would entertain that idea. But I think it is actually, you know, it's a meaningful concept. It actually makes sense that we don't mind, you know, in principle, we want to encourage people to read books. So that's fine. But writers can't always write for free.
No, as you say, the model's there, and it's not really that you're giving more money to the libraries. You're giving it to the people who produce the books, the people who write the books, who at present really aren't getting any of it. And I don't want to see it come at the expense of libraries, because I think libraries do just a ton of things. You know, even beyond lending books, they've become in our time almost community hubs of a sort, and they're delivering all kinds of useful social services, like giving people computer access and so on. So, you know, this isn't a rant against libraries. It's just an unintended consequence of the growth and success of libraries that we're in a situation now where a lot of books are going out the door for free that could be sold. And there is really strong data that shows that it's not that, you know, people who borrow books, the library apologists will always say that people who borrow books also buy books, but there is strong data out there that shows that they buy fewer books than they would if they weren't available from libraries, and that most of the people borrowing from libraries are actually people who are upper income and reading for entertainment, not for education purposes. So it's something we can definitely, I think, address, but probably won't be addressable until we're at a time, you know, of crisis in the book industry, and jobs are starting to disappear and authors aren't getting anything.
Well, it is almost always true that nothing happens until it's a crisis.
Yes.
So, Ken, I want to thank you for being my guest, and this has been really fun. This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about books and publishing. I'm David Wilk, your host. I've been talking to Ken White from Sutherland House, north of the border in Canada. Thank you.